Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. Today on the show, Jill Robbins and Alice Bryant bring us the Health and Lifestyle Report. We close the program with our American History Program, The Making of a Nation. But first, here's Brian Lynn.
Japan has been collecting snow this winter to be used to help cool areas during this year's Summer Olympics in Tokyo. But lower than usual snowfall this year has forced officials to rethink the effort. Some of the work has taken place in the mountain city of Minami Uonuma in Niigata Prefecture, north of Tokyo. Workers have been trying to collect and store snow to bring by train to areas where Olympic soccer and basketball events will be held. The snow is supposed to be used to cool buildings. Organizers also plan to give out the snow to Olympic visitors as they arrive for events. Summer temperatures around Tokyo often rise to at least 40 degrees Celsius. Organizers are also planning to use misting machines and water stations to keep Olympic attendees cool. The use of snow to cool structures is not new in Japan and some other countries. In Norway, for example, the country's airport in Oslo uses snow collected and stored during the winter to cool buildings in the summer. Usually, the mountains in Niigata receive some of the heaviest snow levels in Japan. But this year, snow amounts dropped sharply. They could end up being the lowest since record-keeping began in 1981. The information on snow levels came from Japan's meteorological agency. Mutsumi Seki is helping lead snow collection efforts at the Minami Uonuma project. Seki told Reuters, "We had to change the snow gathering site from last year to an area where we can expect more snow." So far, the city has only collected 1,400 cubic meters of snow. That is lower than the 2,000 cubic meters it collected last year when it tested the workability of the plan. Snow depths in areas along the Sea of Japan fell by as much as 15% a decade in the years between 1962 and 2016. Those numbers come from a 2018 study by Japan's Ministry of Environment. Michael Mann is a professor at Pennsylvania State University. He told Reuters that the climate changes in Japan are part of a much larger pattern of unusual warmth around the entire Northern Hemisphere this winter. Mann added that he believes this pattern is connected to human-caused planetary warming. Masami Yoshima runs a resort in the city of Nagano, which is next to Niigata. He also said he believes that global warming is causing the drop in snowfall. "There's very little snow, about a third of what we get here every year," he said. "It's very painful." Officials in Japan's northern city of Sapporo are hoping to bring the 2030 Winter Olympics to that city. Sapporo hosted the Winter Olympics back in 1972. This past December and January, very little snow fell in the area. Then, in early February, it finally arrived. A winter storm dropped about 34 centimeters of snow during a period of just 6 hours. Local officials welcomed the snow, but they continue to watch the weather very closely as they prepare for a possible Olympic award. One weather expert told the Associated Press he thinks the lack of snow, followed by the large amount falling in a short period, may also be a sign that the local climate is changing. "We often have this kind of event," said Dr. Tomonori Sato, a professor at Hokkaido University. "However, the magnitude was abnormal. This is maybe because of warming temperatures." I'm Brian Lynn.
Aaliyah Farrow remembers the doctor who sent her to another doctor after learning she identified as queer. The doctor who would not treat her was a woman who specializes in women's health. For Ree Ledgerwood, it was a doctor advising about things like pregnancy prevention. Ledgerwood was designated female at birth, but now identifies as transgender and does not have sex with men. Transgender people have a gender identity different from that designated at birth. For Tim Keyes, it is when doctors thought he was sexually active with women. But he had no interest in having sex with women. When he was 17 years old, Keyes announced that he was gay. Ask any LGBTQ patient about their experiences with doctor visits, and chances are they will have an unpleasant story to tell. The term LGBTQ is short for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer. When doctors think all of their patients are heterosexual, those who identify in other ways can feel ignored. They also are less likely to seek medical care. This can lead to health problems, including high rates of depression, suicidal behavior, alcohol and drug use, and ineffective health screenings. That information comes from LGBTQ advocates in the United States. But changes are coming to the medical field, these advocates say.
For example, the American Medical Association, or AMA, promised in November to push for a federal ban on conversion therapy. The treatment attempts to turn members of the LGBTQ community into heterosexuals. In addition, U.S. medical schools are expanding education on LGBTQ health issues, and some schools are pushing to have more LGBTQ medical students. Research shows that patients often get better care when treated by doctors who are more like them. Farrow, Keyes, and Ledgerwood are part of that movement. They are all studying for careers in medicine. Farrow is a third-year medical student at Harvard University in Massachusetts. she told the Associated Press that LGBTQ doctors should be treated like other members of the medical community. She also thinks LGBTQ patients should get the same quality of care other patients get. Increasing LGBTQ student enrollment in medical schools and training in LGBTQ health issues can help reach those goals, advocates say. Exact numbers of these medical students and doctors are unknown. In 2018, the AMA added sexual and gender identity to the information members could choose to include on their profiles. Of the 15,000 doctors and students who have volunteered that information so far, about 4% identify as LGBTQ.
In autumn of 2019, Harvard's entering class of medical students was 15% LGBTQ, a high rate that is no accident. Harvard asks students if they want to be identified as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer. An answer is not required, but the choice sends a message that you're wanted, said Jessica Hallam. She works with LGBTQ students at the medical school. We know that doctors need to look like and be part of the communities they serve, Hallam said. We have gay Muslim students, lesbians from China, students who are survivors of conversion therapy, she said. They are now out and very proud gay people, and they are healing those wounds. In the beginning, Aaliyah Farrow planned to present herself as heterosexual in medical school. She feared that making the truth known would cause patients to dislike her and make her feel different from the other students. But Harvard has an active LGBTQ student group and teachers who ask students what their chosen pronoun is. It also has classes dealing with LGBTQ medical care. During a recent visit to one of Harvard's sister hospitals, Farrow was happy to see some patients there with their same-sex partners. She said doctors who were training her smoothly asked about people's lives and were at ease when learning patients were queer. All are important steps, Farrow says, toward offering non-judgmental, patient-centered care.
The Association of American Medical Colleges reports that while most schools offer LGBTQ courses, half reported three or fewer classes, group discussions, or other learning activities. And a study of medical students, published in March 2019, found a serious lack of knowledge on LGBTQ health issues. Carl Streed was the lead writer of a report on the study. He is a doctor and an associate professor at Boston University's medical school. Streed said that a bad experience with a doctor 15 years ago, when he was sick, made him want to join the medical field. When he told the doctor he was gay, the doctor became very unfriendly and then suggested HIV testing, left the room, and never came back. Streed was a young student at the time. Testing elsewhere showed he did not have the virus, but no one suggested tests for infections more common among college students. And he never found out what his sickness was. Streed said doctors' personal beliefs should not affect their quality of care and kindness toward patients. Tim Keyes started attending Stanford University's medical school in 2015. Back then, LGBTQ health issues were only discussed in one unrequired class that had low enrollment. But now, expanded coursework is part of the required study program. 2 years ago, Keyes was among six students at four universities who created the Medical Student Pride Alliance. The group now operates at 31 universities across the United States. Its aim is to get more LGBTQ students into medical schools, push for more informed coursework, and improve LGBTQ medical care. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies during the 1930s changed the face of American government. The new president and the Congress passed legislation that helped farmers, strengthened the banking system, and supplied jobs for millions of workers. One of the results of Roosevelt's policies was a stronger movement of organized labor in America. Sarah Long and Doug Johnson continue the story of the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies during the 1930s changed the face of American government. The new president and the Congress passed legislation that helped farmers, strengthened the banking system, and supplied jobs for millions of workers. One of the most important results of Roosevelt's policies was a stronger American labor movement.
Labor leaders had little success in organizing workers in the United States during the 1920s. Three Republican presidents and a national wave of conservatism prevented them from gaining many members or increasing their negotiating power. In 1929, organized labor fell even further with the beginning of the Great Economic Depression. By 1933, America's labor unions had less than 3 million members. But by the end of the 1930s, more than 10.5 million American workers belonged to unions.
New laws proposed by the Roosevelt administration made the labor growth possible. The National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933 gave labor leaders the right to organize and represent workers. The Supreme Court ruled that the law was illegal. But another law, the Wagner Labor Relations Act of 1935, helped labor unions to increase their power. Most of the leaders of America's traditional labor unions were slow to understand their new power. They were conservative men. They represented workers with certain skills, such as woodworkers or metal workers. They did little to organize workers with other kinds of skills. But a new group of labor leaders used the new laws to organize unions by industries, not by skills. They believed that workers would have much more power if they joined forces with other workers in the same factory to make common demands. these new leaders began to organize unions for the automobile industry, the steel industry, and other major industries.
The leader of the new movement was the head of the mine workers, John L. Lewis. Lewis was a powerful leader with a strong body and strong opinions. He had begun to work in the coal mines at the age of 12. Lewis rose to become a powerful and successful leader of the mine workers, but he was concerned about workers in other industries as well. And he believed that most of the leaders in the American Federation of Labor were doing little to help them. For this reason, Lewis and the heads of several other unions formed their own group to organize unions by industry, not by skills. They called their group the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO. And they tried immediately to gain members.
The CIO successfully organized the workers in several major industries, but it succeeded only by hard work and struggle. The CIO's first big battle was against the giant automobile company, General Motors. Late in 1935, workers at several General Motors factories began a sit-down strike at their machines to demand better pay and working conditions. After 45 days, General Motors surrendered. It recognized that the Automobile Workers Union had the right to represent GM workers. And it agreed to negotiate a new work agreement.
The struggle at the Ford Motor Company was more bitter. Ford Company guards beat union organizers and workers. But the Ford Company finally agreed to negotiate with the new union. The same story was true in the steel industry. But the new labor leaders succeeded in becoming the official representatives of steel workers throughout the country. By 1938, the CIO had won its battle to organize major industries. In later years, it would join with the more traditional American Federation of Labor to form the organization that remains the most important labor group in America today, the AFL-CIO.
President Roosevelt was not always an active supporter of organized labor, but neither was he a constant supporter of big business, like the three Republican presidents before him. In fact, Roosevelt spoke out often against the dangers of big business in a democracy. These speeches caused great concern among many of the traditional business and conservative leaders of the nation. And Roosevelt's increasingly progressive policies in 1935 made many richer Americans fear that the president was a socialist, a dictator, or a madman. Former President Herbert Hoover, for example, denounced Roosevelt's New Deal policies as an attack on the whole idea of individual freedoms. The family of business leader J.P. Morgan told visitors not to say Roosevelt's name in front of Morgan. They said it would make his blood pressure go up.
This conservative opposition to Roosevelt grew steadily throughout 1935 and 36. Many Americans were honestly worried that Roosevelt's expansion of government was the first step to dictatorship. They feared that Roosevelt and the Democrats were trying to gain power as the Nazis did in Germany, the fascists in Italy, or the communists in Russia.
The Republican Party held its presidential convention in the summer of 1936. The party delegates chose Alfred Landon to oppose Roosevelt for president. Mr. Landon was the governor of the farm state of Kansas. He was a successful oil producer with conservative business views. But he was open to some of the social reforms of Roosevelt's New Deal. Republicans hoped he would appeal to average Americans who supported mild reforms but feared Roosevelt's social policies. The Democrats nominated Roosevelt and Vice President John Garner to serve a second term.
The main issue in the presidential campaign of 1936 was Franklin Roosevelt himself. Roosevelt campaigned across the country like a man sure that he would win. He laughed with the cheering crowds and told them that the New Deal had helped improve their lives. In New York, Roosevelt made a major speech promising to continue the work of his administration if he was reelected.
Of course, we will continue to seek to improve working conditions for the workers of America. Of course, we will continue to work for cheaper electricity in the homes and on the farms of America. For better and cheaper transportation, for low interest rates, for sounder home financing, for better banking, for the regulation of security issues, for reciprocal trade among nations, and my friends, for all of these, we have only just begun to fight.
The Republican candidate, Alfred Landon, began his campaign by saying that many of Roosevelt's New Deal programs were good. But he said that a Republican administration could do them better and for less money. However, Landon's words became much stronger as the campaign continued. He attacked many of Roosevelt's programs. The campaign became increasingly bitter. Roosevelt said his opponents cared only about their money, not about other Americans. "I welcome their hatred," he said. Landon's supporters accused Roosevelt of destroying the nation's economic traditions and threatening democracy.
The nation had not seen such a fierce campaign in 40 years. But when it was over, the nation also saw a victory greater than any in its history. Franklin Roosevelt defeated Alfred Landon in the election of 1936 by one of the largest votes in the nation's history. Roosevelt won every state except Maine and Vermont. The huge election victory marked the high point of Roosevelt's popularity. In our next program, we will look at the many problems he faced in his second administration.
That's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with more stories from around the world. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.